Today's episode is brought to you by Supplements Made Simple, evidence-based supplements formulated by me, ensuring that you and your family get a meaningful health benefit from your daily supplement routine. Supplements Made Simple is available in pharmacies nationwide or online at mars.ie. Welcome to today's podcast. Today I'm speaking with Dr. Breffni Anglam O'Regan, who's a consultant obstetrician and gynecologist with a subspecialty in urogynecology at the Coombe Hospital. And today we're going to talk about everything to do with incontinence and prolapse. So this is a very common problem. If it affects you or someone you know, this should be a very interesting and hopefully helpful listen for you. If it doesn't affect you, do listen in because it is interesting and it might affect you someday. As I said, this is very common. So welcome, Breffni. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your very busy schedule to join us and to educate us on incontinence and prolapse. Thank you.
Thank you for inviting me. Looking forward to it.
So Breffni, can you first tell us what are the different types of urinary incontinence?
So there are two main types. So the first one would be what's called stress incontinence. So stress incontinence is the leaking of urine with an increase in intra-abdominal pressure. So when you're putting pressure on the pelvic floor, for example, if you're coughing, sneezing, lifting, walking, running. And so it's more of the pelvic floor itself. So the hammock that sits at the bottom of your pelvis, that's where the damage is done. And then the other main type is what's called overactive bladder. So that's more of an issue with the bladder muscle itself. So it's got nothing really to do with the pelvic floor. Well, rarely has it anything to do with the pelvic floor. But so usually as you fill your bladder, your bladder muscle should not contract. And then when you decide that you want to go to the toilet to pass urine, you activate your bladder muscle and you pee. So with overactive bladder, you can get spasming of the bladder muscle itself as your bladder fills, which shouldn't happen. And most of the time, this is something that's idiopathic. So it happens spontaneously and there's no cause for it. So there are the two broad types of urinary incontinence that there are. So, and about 20 to 30% of women will have both stress incontinence and overactive bladder. So there is an overlap. You can have both types of symptoms.
Okay, so there's stress incontinence and then there's OAB, overactive bladder, sometimes as well called urge incontinence, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah.
And then mixed. So up to one third of women will have mixed incontinence. So then there is, so what about prolapse then? What exactly is prolapse and what types of prolapse are there?
So prolapse is what we would refer to as a herniation. So the vagina, the organ, so sometimes your uterus can come down or your bladder can come down or your rectum can come down and they just slip down into the vagina and protrude into the vagina when they shouldn't. And usually most women will present, so you can have the vagina might be prolapsing a little bit, so the organs can be prolapsing into the vagina and you may not feel it, but when it comes to a certain point, usually once it's beyond the hymen, so the opening into the vagina, that's when most people will feel a bulge. So you might go to your GP and they'll say, oh look, you've a little bit of prolapse, but you can't feel anything. And it's not uncommon after you've delivered a baby to have a bit of prolapse, particularly when you're breastfeeding and your tissues are more lax because of the hormonal changes while you're breastfeeding and the lack of estrogen. And then generally once you stop it, it goes back to normal and then you'll be fine. And then usually once the estrogen starts to dry up again, i.e. around the menopause, perimenopause, that's when people become symptomatic of it. So they can feel it more and it starts to come down further and further. So that's prolapse is more the pelvic floor. It's again like stress incontinence, it's damage to the pelvic floor itself. Mm-hmm. And also the tissue in the vagina is more lax and it's stretched. So that's what prolapse is.
Okay. So then with prolapse, so a feeling like a pressure feeling at say in your pelvic area, would you have pain or incontinence or feeling of constipation? Do you have any other pelvic symptoms, or is it the main feeling is a pulling, dragging pressure sensation?
So most people will typically feel a ball, like a ball or a bulge, something coming down between their legs. They'll physically feel something in their vagina coming down between their legs, depending on the severity of how far down it is as they walk around. But also they will have a lot of overlap with urinary and bowel symptoms. So constipation is usually higher up, and you may or may not have constipation incidentally when you have prolapse. But specifically, if you feel that when you do pass a bowel movement, if you feel you're not emptying your bowels fully, and in a severe scenario where you have to put your finger into your vagina to empty your bowels, which is called splinting, some women with severe prolapse of the rectum can have that symptom. But constipation generally isn't really as a result of the prolapse. So if you fix a prolapse with a pessary or with surgery, it won't get rid of constipation per se. In terms of bladder symptoms, you generally people will feel that they have to double void a lot. So they'll empty their bladder, they'll go to the toilet, sit on the toilet and pee, and then, but they won't feel like they're empty fully. So their bladder might be bulging into their vagina a little bit, and then they have to lean forward, or again, sometimes they may have to put their finger into their vagina just to get that last bit of urine out. They can sometimes have a slow stream, so it might take them a while to start. Again, that bit of the bladder is just sitting in the vagina, so they can't empty fully. And a lot of women will have, because it's prolapse is damage, the cause is damage to the pelvic floor, they may also have stress incontinence as well. So they'll leak when they cough, sneeze, lift. And also, if you have a bladder prolapse, you're like the urine, if the bladder is never really fully emptying, so you have a little bit of urine sitting in your bladder all the time. So you can get that constant urgency feeling, and also frequency. So if you have, if you're not emptying your bladder fully, you're going to the toilet, you're emptying your bladder, but it's only half emptying. So instead of a normal person going 6 or 7 times a day, if you're only half emptying your bladder each time you go, then you're going to have to go double the amount. And it also can predispose them to getting recurrent urinary tract infections or kidney infections, because that stale urine is just sitting in their bladder.
Yeah. And you're describing it so well there in terms of, you know, how one problem leads to another. And it's kind of like, it's almost like this vicious cycle of really, you know, upsetting, disabling, bothersome symptoms that have a huge impact on people's quality of life, their relationships, their work, their confidence. So, you know, it's really important to talk about it if people are, because I've had a lot of patients over the years that have been suffering from it, but just haven't reported it for a long time. People feel, I think a lot of people feel like they kind of have to put up with it a lot of the time.
Oh, yeah. Like, the, I do feel people are becoming a lot more vocal about it. And obviously, everybody tells me all their gynae issues, because that's who I am. Yeah. But like, people will, in clinic, they'll be like, oh, I've had this for years. I just thought it was normal. I just thought I had to put up with it. And I was like, absolutely not. And you have another 20 to 30 years of or 30 years to go. You do not have to put up with this. There's easy fixes to it. We don't even have to look at surgery. There are pessaries and other things you can try. But and a lot of the time, actually, so usually the common age of onset of menopause is 51, 52. Some people are a little bit earlier, some people are a little bit later. But usually about like 3-4 years into the menopause, the lack of estrogen, particularly in the vagina, will be a lot more noticeable. And the tissues are quite dry at that stage. And a lot of women will report pain with intercourse because of the dryness of the tissues and the lack of lubrication. And they will also, even if they don't have very bad prolapse, they might experience, they'll describe a pressure, particularly when they're walking. And a lot of the time, if you give them local estrogen in the form of a tablet, which is Vagifem, or a cream called Ovestin, or there's like little little capsules that you can put in, they're kind of wax bullets called Invagis. After a month or two, that might treat all their symptoms and they're fine. And it's very, I think a lot of people with HRT previously were very anxious about prescribing HRT. But I think the main thing about this is that it's a locally acting vaginal estrogen. It does not get absorbed into your system. So it doesn't have the same side effect profile in terms of breast and uterine cancer risks and clots that like systemic HRT that a patch or a tablet would have. So oftentimes, not oftentimes, but like most people that leave my clinic, unless there's a contraindication, will leave with Vagifem. But a lot of the time, like that will help significantly with their prolapse symptoms, with their stress incontinence symptoms, and their overactive bladder symptoms.
Yes, that's such an important message, Breffni. You know, local estrogen in terms of Vagifem or Ovestin, it can be really life changing for people, and it stops. It can really actually. I've had a few patients, and Vagifem alone has just stopped all of these symptoms and really given people back a huge quality of life. A lot of people come to me as well about HRT, and you know, maybe they just need some Vagifem. You know, they don't need the patches or the gel or the progesterone and all of that. Vagifem oftentimes takes care of a lot of these problems, and it can help with pain during intercourse as well. And the message that you shared as well, that it doesn't have any associated increased risk of any, you know, of clots or of cancer. It's locally acting. So, you know, almost every woman in a way, if you have symptoms, should give it a try at least anyway to see if it helps.
And so, it's also the first line treatment for recurrent urinary tract infections.
Yes.
Rather than having, because this is what I did my MD on, so it alters the microbiome of the vagina. So the bacterial makeup of the vagina, it will alter. And as a result of that, it alters the bacterial makeup of the bladder. So previously, up until about 10 years ago, we thought the bladder was sterile. But actually, there are kind of low numbers of bacteria in it. And what the Vagifem does is it changes the makeup of that bacteria in the bladder, and it stops you from getting recurrent UTIs in the majority of cases.
Yeah.
Rather than going on one set of antibiotics after another.
Yeah. It's a nightmare. Yeah, and it's just recurrent antibiotics, and then, you know, prophylactic antibiotics, take an antibiotic every night, and then people get candidiasis, you know, thrush, and it's one thing after the other. And then they have vaginal atrophy or atrophic vaginitis, and that's causing discomfort as well. And really just almost all of these problems can be stopped with a straightforward local acting estrogen. So if a patient is having any of these symptoms, they go to their GP, I suppose, what to expect at the GP surgery, you know, history, examination, checking the urine just to make sure that it's not something straightforward like a urinary tract infection, and then maybe a trial of medications. Are there any medications that you prefer to use, Breffni, for OAB?
For overactive bladder, a lot of it is lifestyle changes. So you take a history and you start from scratch. So a lot of Irish people drink a lot of tea.
Yeah, which I'm drinking tea right now.
Exactly, which is I thankfully have gone off tea and coffee in pregnancy, but other than that, but like if you're drinking tea, coffee, green tea, Diet Coke is a big one. Mm-hmm. So they're all bladder irritants. So that can like make you feel like you have an urge to pass urine a lot more. And like I'm talking about women who are drinking 6 to 10 cups of tea a day, which they don't need for the caffeine. So a simple scenario there is just to change to decaf, which obviously you have to do gradually so you don't get that. So that's one thing. A lot of people could be drinking 2-3 liters a day. So if I drank 2 or 3 liters of fluids a day, I would be peeing more frequently. Mm-hmm. And that's just what goes in must come out. So I would usually tell women to reduce their fluid intake to about 1.5 liters.
Mm-hmm.
The other big thing is most women who are postmenopausal will get up out of bed to pass urine because they have an urge to pass urine once a night, and that's normal.
Okay.
If you drink your cup of tea before you go to bed, or any fluids before you go to bed and then get into bed, you may be getting up 2 or 3 times. So a simple lifestyle modification there is to stop drinking fluids 3 hours before bed. And if you have to take your medications, you can usually take them at 7 o'clock as opposed to taking them at 10 o'clock. Then the other thing is weight will make a difference to overactive bladder and stress incontinence, so leaking when you cough and sneeze. So weight loss will usually help with that as well. And then Vagifem, if it's, so women who have had breast cancer, if they are, if they, or endometrial cancer, once they're 5 years out from their diagnosis and they're free from their cancer diagnosis, you can start Vagifem at that point and it is safe.
Mm-hmm.
So most women, as I said, most of my women, well, overactive bladder is kind of a mixed of pre and postmenopausal, but anyone who's postmenopausal, I would start them on Vagifem because it relieves those urgency symptoms. And there is a lot of overlap between lower urinary tract symptoms that you have with associated urinary tract infections and overactive bladder. So you're kind of treating both of those at the same time. So that's usually what we do. If someone has very severe symptoms, so if they're voiding, if they're passing urine every hour and they have a lot of incontinence, so they have a strong urge to urinate, they're not getting to the bathroom on time and they're leaking, then I would usually start a medication from the first visit, from the get-go. So previously what we would have always prescribed was what's called an anticholinergic medication, but this can have some side effects such as dry eyes, dry mouth, constipation. And of course, if you have symptoms that are severe, you're going to stop taking that medication. So most commonly what I would prescribe now would be a medication called Betmega, which thankfully doesn't have as many side effects, and therefore women are more likely to take it every day and notice a big improvement with it. And that will, it reduces those urgency symptoms that need to pee all the time. And it also increases your bladder capacity, so it allows you to hold it a bit more. So, and then what I do is I give lots of leaflets. There's a lot of information to take in when you come in to see me. So I usually give a lot of leaflets and have this all written down. And then I'll also tell them how to do bladder retraining. So a lot of the time it's kind of mind over matter. So if you, I would tell a woman, if you have an urge to pass urine, I want you to tense your pelvic floor until that urge passes and then you relax again. And then I want you to go to the toilet 5 minutes later. And then I'd say do that for a week and then slowly build it up to 10 minutes the next week and gradually up to a half an hour. And oftentimes if you're combining that with the medication, it'll be a lot easier to do, with the view in time of weaning off the medication completely and having retrained your bladder to hold it for longer. So that's the end game. So most women won't need to be on medication forever. But some people have more severe symptoms. So you have them on one medication and then you'll see them about 3-4 months later. It usually takes a month or two for the medication to kick in. And then you will start them on a second medication, which usually then is an anticholinergic. So you kind of have to pick which one works best for the patient in terms of their side effects. And so once a woman is still leaking urine with urgency, the next step would be Botox.
Okay.
And we're all familiar with Botox. It causes paralysis of a muscle. That's how we get rid of our wrinkles. So we inject this into the bladder muscle. So we look into the, when you're asleep usually, and you look into the bladder and then just with a needle, you inject Botox around. And that would be in very severe cases. I wouldn't have to do that commonly. And usually women will get relief of between 4 to 9 months out of that.
Okay.
So that's kind of like the end. And there's also an option of sacral neuromodulation, which they do in Beaumont. And it's usually a urologist who would do that, and equally it would have a similar effect to Botox. And it's kind of women that aren't responding to medication. That's the kind of end of the line where we go to.
Okay. There's so many great lifestyle tips there, Breffni, that, you know, we need to, you know, I suppose recap on, you know, cutting back on caffeinated drinks, switching to decaf, you know, limiting water or fluid intake to 1.5 liters a day, the bladder retraining. So there's so much that we can be, you know, doing at home ourselves, you know, and before needing to start medication. And as other important things, you know, managing constipation is important as well, isn't it, for pressure on the pelvic floor. And just as we were discussing there, so it's important to remember as well that if you are having these urinary symptoms of polyuria, going to the toilet a lot, or urgency frequency, you know, you just can be
issues there as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I was just going to say it. Yeah, we will. Your GP will, you know, when we dip the urine, if there is glucose in that, that will show up a diagnosis of type 2 diabetes. Then as well, in terms of, you know, non-invasive or non-surgical management, physiotherapy as well, pelvic floor physio and Kegels are so important as well, aren't they?
For overactive bladder, not as much, but they will do bladder retraining with you. But very rarely, if you have a woman who has pain in their pelvis for a variety of reasons, such as endometriosis or something that's giving them pain in their pelvis, and it can also be IBS, anything like that, they can, as a response to that pain, they contract their pelvic floor. So your pelvic floor is a hammock sitting at the bottom of your abdomen that should just be relaxed all the time. And sometimes in response to pain, people will reflexly contract their pelvic floor, so it'll be tight. Just like if I'm stressed or if anyone's stressed, you will have knots in your shoulders and around your neck. So this, you can equate that to having knots in your pelvic floor. So if you need to pass urine then, so in order to pass urine, you have to contract your bladder muscle, and then you relax your pelvic floor and you pass urine. But if your pelvic floor is very, very tight, you're not able to empty your bladder fully. And as a result, you'll only half empty your bladder. You'll have frequency and urgency. So it's rare, but sometimes women with a tight pelvic floor as a result of chronic pelvic pain, I would send them to physio, and what they would do is what's called myofascial release. So, and if you want to compare it to getting a massage on your shoulders, but you're getting it in your vagina, and it's very much not a quick fix. Like, it takes a long time to kind of work through it, because you have to, they'll teach you breathing techniques as well. You have to relearn how to relax your pelvic floor. So that is, physio is very much would be used in that scenario for overactive bladder.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I was listening to a pelvic floor physiotherapist recently talking about the importance of our breathing patterns, because when your diaphragm, it will have an impact on the intra-abdominal, you know, pressure, and then the pressure on your pelvic floor. So it's totally fascinating. You know, and these pelvic floor physiotherapists have such a huge role to play in the management of keeping our pelvic floor healthy. But I don't think people know that a lot. But I actually think people don't know about just physiotherapy just in general anyway. People forget about it a lot of the time. But the thing about physio, whether it's pelvic floor physio or, you know, sports physiotherapy, it is a slow and steady process, but it can be very, very effective, you know.
Oh, hugely effective. So that would be if someone has a tight pelvic floor, that's the first line treatment of it.
Yeah.
And also, if you're tensing your pelvic floor, you will oftentimes have postural changes. So you might be getting pain in your hip. Just like if you injure your knee, you'll get referred hip pain. If you're tensing your pelvic floor, you're going to posturally change even how you're walking, which will affect your hips.
Yeah.
The physios have a huge part to play in just realigning everything, but it takes time and work to get through it.
Yeah. Yeah. And undoing all of our bad habits. I will have a pelvic floor physiotherapist on another episode shortly, so we can get into that more at that time. What are some of the causes, Brephany? Because I know you've mentioned peri and postmenopausal women a lot, but this can happen, like, these symptoms, I suppose, particularly of incontinence, can happen women at any age, can't it?
So overactive bladder is usually idiopathic, so it just happens spontaneously. If your mum has it or your sisters have it, it's not related in that way at all. It can just happen spontaneously. But obviously the more severe cases will be maybe someone with MS, someone who's had a spinal injury or a stroke, but they would be a lot more complex. But the majority of cases, it just happens for no reason. But it also is very treatable. So it's not something. Whereas stress incontinence by comparison is very much, it would be very rare to meet a woman with stress incontinence, so leaking when you cough, sneeze, walk, who hasn't had a vaginal delivery.
Okay.
Yeah. It's usually the passage. And that's not to say that everybody who has a vaginal delivery is going to have stress incontinence. But generally, carrying of the pregnancy and particularly delivering of the head of the baby through the vagina, be it via an instrumental delivery such as a forceps or a vacuum, or just a normal vaginal delivery, about 10 to 15% of women as a result of that at the time, but usually postmenopausally, will have stress incontinence. And the reason that it is more symptomatic postmenopausally is because estrogen, again, plays a huge role in the strength, the tensile strength of the vaginal tissues and the pelvic floor. So that's usually when people will present with it.
Yeah, okay, that's when it declares itself. So other than doing our Kegel exercises regularly, is there anything, you know, that, say, younger women now who aren't peri or postmenopausal, say they've had a vaginal delivery, they're listening to this now, they're thinking, okay, I don't have any of these symptoms, but I don't want them. Is there anything that women can do to prevent it or to reduce the severity besides Vagifem? So we've said that Vagifem can help hugely. Is there anything else in terms of lifestyle, like in prevention, Brefni?
So usually, like most people who are pregnant will have the odd leak when they're walking towards the end of their pregnancy, and that's purely from the pressure of the gravid uterus. And sadly, that's just a fact of life. And the most people, once they've had their baby, they're fine and they don't have it anymore. But it's very important, as you said, to do your Kegel exercises when you are pregnant and after you've had the baby. But if you feel like, and a lot of people will say, look, I can't get on a trampoline with my kids and without leaking. But that's putting your pelvis under a lot of pressure. But most people, other than that, if they cough and sneeze, they don't leak. But it's very important. So lifestyle modifications for stress incontinence will be, so smoking is a big one. You don't want to damage any of your vaginal tissues or your pelvic floor. Smoking is a toxin and will have an effect on it. Being overweight will put, so any extra pressure on your pelvic floor, particularly obesity, will put a huge pressure on your pelvic floor. So we know that that improves, losing weight will improve stress incontinence symptoms. Constipation, as you said, if you're, again, that puts pressure on the pelvic floor. If you're very constipated, your bowel is just beside your bladder. So if you don't empty your bowel properly, you're not able to empty your bladder properly. So that will have a huge effect as well. And then also, sometimes women can hold it, and teachers and doctors are awful for this, but you'll hold it for a long period of time, especially if you're in a class or if you're in a clinic or something.
Oh, no, I'm getting nervous here now. How bad is that to do?
Well, no, but like if you have, like, yeah, we all do it. But if you, so say you drink 2 liters a day and you're only going to the toilet 3 times a day, that means every time you pee, you're peeing out 600 or 700 mils, which is a lot. So most women's bladders only hold 400 to 600 mils, so a half a liter. But if you're really pushing it and then your bladder is really, really full and then you cough, you're a lot more likely to leak urine. Whereas what I would do with a lot of people in that scenario is I would be like, look, you need to go to the toilet every 2 to 3 hours and pee 400 each time. And then you won't have that tipping your bladder to the point where you're leaking them with a small little impulse like a cough or a sneeze or a walk.
Okay, right.
So timed toileting is what that's called.
Yes, okay. I need to get better at that. But you're right. It's just, it's one of those things, like in the workplace, you know, particularly for teachers and doctors, it is just difficult to get out of a very busy clinic or for you.
The bladder is very difficult because they can't leave the classroom.
Yes.
That's very hard.
Yeah. So then, say if a patient does go to you, are there any investigations, like say in terms of, you know, urodynamics or cystoscopy, camera test scans, are there any investigations that should be done?
So a cystoscopy is looking into the bladder with a camera. Usually this can be done awake. You just put in some local anesthetic gel And you can do that very easily. I wouldn't do that very commonly unless if someone has recurrent urinary tract infections, I would have a look in to make sure there's no, and I would also do a renal ultrasound, so a scan to look at their kidneys to make sure I'm not missing any stones or anything like that. And I'd have a look into their bladder to make sure there's no stones in there or any sinister pathology like a bladder cancer, which would be very rare. Mm-hmm. If anyone has blood in their urine persistently, then you would also want to make sure that there's no bladder cancer. But generally, or if someone has bladder pain, so if they are, when they're before they need to pass urine and leading up to it, if they have severe pain in their pubic area, so just above, just in their lower pelvis, you want to make sure that there's no other cause of bladder pain, such as interstitial cystitis, then you would have a look into someone's bladder. But again, that wouldn't be very common. So usually for urodynamics is a test that you put a tube into the bladder, a small little tube. It's one of our urodynamics nurses usually does that. And then you put another tube into someone's rectum. So you can detect the pressure in the bladder and the rectum. And by subtracting one from the other, you can determine what the pressure of the bladder muscle itself is. So with that test, we have a bag of water, and it's usually warmed up to a degree, so it feels like normal urine filling your bladder, and you slowly fill someone's bladder through the tube that's connected into the bladder. And what we do is we get women to cough at intervals. Usually when there's 100 mils in the bladder, we'll get them to cough, and then every 100 mils up until 400 or 500 mils, we'll get them to cough. And they're sitting on a little toilet seat that has a pressure sensor underneath. So if they leak, the pressure sensor will detect it, and that will tell us whether or not they're leaking when they're coughing and sneezing with a deficient pelvic floor. Or it will also tell us if there's any overactivity, so any spasms in the bladder muscles as it's filling. So it's just one way of testing, particularly if you would need to have that before you do Botox, because oftentimes someone will give you a history, and then, but that test will tell you something different, not commonly, but it can do. So if you're to do Botox or a sling surgery on someone, you're doing the wrong thing. Yeah. So you can get what sometimes it's called a cough induced detrusor overactivity. So if you cough, it will cause your detrusor, your bladder muscle, to contract, and you'll leak urine. So you're coughing and you're leaking urine, but it's because you're stimulating your bladder muscle. So in that scenario, a sling surgery is not going to do the job. You need something to calm down the spasms in your bladder muscle. So it's a very important test to do before you do any surgery for stress incontinence.
Yes,
and for Botox. And it'll also tell you how much your bladder can hold. So what is the capacity of your bladder? And oftentimes if someone has had radiation, say for cervical cancer or cancer of the lining of the womb, sometimes their bladder can't hold as much, so it'll be able to tell us that. But usually we don't do it that commonly, but particularly before surgery we would do it.
Okay, so it kind of helps to tell whether it is this stress or urge or mixed type picture. It'll give kind of more information and help you then make a decision on what the best management going forward for the patient is. So then you mentioned as well when we did an Instagram live, there's also a treatment, a kind of injecting a bulking agent in around the urethra, isn't it? Is that it? To help with, this is with stress incontinence?
Yeah. So for stress incontinence, there's four different types of procedures that you can do. Bulkamid is a hydrogel. So most people will be familiar with filler material from cosmetic medicine. So it's not, it's a hydrogel. So you inject it in and around the bladder neck when you're asleep. Some people do it awake, but I've seen that done a few times and women don't really tolerate it that well. And if they move, you don't place the gel as well. And what it does, rather than the bladder neck being open, well, it is open, but it just narrows the outlet. So instead of you leaking a large amount, you leak less. But it's not giving the support to the bladder neck that you would have with other procedures. So the success rate is usually is about 50%. And you very much have to pick the patients that you do this for. So so say someone who you have them on the table, you get them to cough and they have a small little dribble. And say they in their history, they're telling you, okay, they're leaking once or twice a day, or so not a huge amount, as opposed to someone you get them to cough on your table and it sprays everywhere. And they're leaking several times a day. Bulkamid is not going to work for someone that latter person, whereas for someone who has less severe, so more mild stress incontinence, it is more likely to work. And usually, so the success is 50%. Sometimes you need to do it twice, and generally we wouldn't do it beyond that.
Okay. And you said, so you said there are four types of treatments. So there is that including the Botox? No.
So Botox is, I wouldn't really term that as a surgery because for me, it's a medication. Okay. That's for overactive bladder. But for stress incontinence, which is a weakened pelvic floor, the other three surgical options. So the one that is unfortunately on hold in Ireland at the moment is a mesh TBT. And this is the gold standard treatment for stress incontinence. And everywhere else in the world except Ireland and the UK, it is the first line treatment. The reason being that the success rate is 80 to 85% at 20 years. Mm. So the long-term success rate of the surgery is incredible compared to any surgical procedure, really. And it's been very well researched. But there is, with any surgery, there is always risks of complications. And so with a TBT sling, there is a risk of about 1%. So one in 100 women can have what's called a mesh erosion. So that's when you place the mesh below the bladder neck. And the idea being that you are forming a hammock and supporting the bladder neck so that when you cough and sneeze, you don't leak. But sometimes you can have a small area of erosion. So the mesh comes through into the vaginal skin. And most women may have a bit of bleeding, or more commonly, their other half will feel it during intercourse. It'll be like a barbed wire during intercourse. And that's usually treated quite easily. You just cut out that small bit of mesh and then cover it over with the surrounding vaginal skin. You can also get about 15% of women can have new onset overactive bladder symptoms, so urgency and frequency after the surgery, which again is very treatable. But equally, 10 to 15% of women who have overactive bladder before the surgery don't have it afterwards. So that's the TBT, which is currently on hold, but hopefully it will be coming back soon, because it really is, like, most women I meet who have had a TBT are still dry and they had it 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
The other two options are a fascial sling. So you harvest a bit of, so you, where you have a C-section, you go in the same area and you take a little bit of what's called fascia out. So it's a strong connective tissue that we use. And you pass it in the same way that you pass the mesh TBT. And then you just close up where you've harvested the fascia from on your tummy. But the problem with that surgery, so initially the success rates are pretty equivalent to a mesh TBT, but over time the success rates wane. So because you've used tissue that you've harvested from your own body, it's not as strong as a synthetic tissue like mesh. So the success rates would be a lot. At 10 years, it may not even work anymore. Mm. Or it will be about 50 to 60% between 5 to 10 years later. And also there's a lot of voiding dysfunction with it. So after you've had the surgery, the recovery, a TBT in terms of pain isn't huge. Like, you may have a week or two of pain, but with a fascial sling, you've made a big a cut into your tummy, so it's like recovering from a C-section. It could be up to 6 weeks recovery, and a lot of women can have voiding dysfunction afterwards, so they may not be able to pee after they've had the surgery in about 15 to 20% of women. And some women may have to have either a tube in the bladder for a few weeks, or they may have to teach themselves how to empty their bladder properly. There's also the risk of urinary tract infections with it. And overactive bladder symptoms, so frequency and urgency, would be more in the area of about 20 to 30% of women.
Okay.
That's a fascial thing. And then a birch kalpa suspension is the last option, and that can either be done openly or with keyhole surgery. So for keyhole surgery, the recovery will be a lot quicker. But you, what you're doing is you're placing stitches. Again, you're trying to recreate a hammock, so a support for the bladder neck. So you're putting stitches around the bladder neck to lift it up and support it. And then an equivalent, it's the outcomes are pretty much the same as the fascial sling that I just described. So the urinary retention, so not being able to pee afterwards, and the overactive bladder symptoms and the long-term successes would be kind of equal between the two surgeries. So these would have been the commonly done procedures up until about the year 2000 when they introduced the TBT. And because the TBT success rates are so high and the complications are so low, that's why we started using the TBTs a lot more and really didn't use fascial slings or birch kalpa suspensions for years because the TBT was so good.
And because the mesh is currently on hold, what is most commonly being done now at the moment is the fascial sling?
Most people are doing Bulkamid, but again, it's not, and people are doing fascial. It depends really, like you we don't choose what surgeries we do anymore. We very much give the option to the patient, through each surgery type, and the patient decides what they think is most suitable for them. But Bulkamid, I suppose, there's no real complications with Bulkamid, but the success rates aren't great.
Yes.
So people are kind of doing that a lot more.
Okay. And then we didn't talk as well about, you know, ring and shelf pessaries, which can be very helpful for some women as well for prolapse, can't they?
Well, actually, the other thing for stress incontinence that you can do is you can use a pessary with a knob. So there's a little knob at the front of the pessary that you will support the bladder neck. So if someone has incontinence, the success rate of those pessaries, which you teach women to take in and out themselves, which is being able to self-manage your own pessary, has a huge, huge satisfaction for women. So that's another option. So for stress incontinence, it's usually physio, a pessary, and then or surgery. But for prolapse, depending on the type of prolapse you have, pessaries don't work very well for rectal prolapse. So prolapse of the posterior, the back wall of the vagina. But they do work very well for the bladder and the womb prolapsing down into the vagina. So it's very much then based on what stage prolapse you have. So there's stage zero, which is no prolapse, and four, which is when it's the whole way out of the vagina. So stage zero, 1 to 2, usually a ring pessary, which is kind of like, it's about a centimeter wide and various sizes. You collapse it down and then put it into the vagina, and then it opens up at the top of the vagina and is supported by the pubic bone in your vagina. That will usually work for the majority of patients. And also you can teach women to take that in and out. So if they're young and sexually active, you can teach them how to take that in and out very easily. And then they come back to you. It can be as late as 5 years to get a new ring, because that's how long they last. Sometimes you may have to change the size of your pessary, but usually 5 years is how long they last for the silicone ones. If someone has a stage 3 to 4 prolapse, so a lot more significant, like it's really coming down and out of the vagina, then a ring pessary won't work. And you'll have to look at pessaries, as you mentioned, a shelf pessary or a Gellhorn pessary, which unfortunately you can't be sexually active with. So, and that's kind of the limitation of it. I've had one 8-year-old actually who was adamant she wanted to teach. She wanted to take it in and out herself, and she did it.
Yeah.
So it can be done, but it's more of a, rather than just being a supportive device, it kind of creates a suction at the top of the vagina. That's how a Gellhorn works, and it lifts everything right up. So it's more difficult to remove. So most women with a Gellhorn or a shelf pessary, they will have to come in every 3 to 4 months to have it taken out and cleaned and put back in.
Yes. Okay. By usually like a pessary nurse, isn't there? I know there was a pessary clinic in when I was a junior in CUMH. There was pessary clinics, and we used to change the pessaries then for people who needed them changed. But it's I hadn't really heard actually people managing their own pessaries, up until now.
Yeah, well, we did it. I did my fellowship in Canada and we did it a lot over there. And we also did a study on it, and the satisfaction rates are way higher if you can self-manage your own pessary.
Absolutely. And then I think probably any woman who needs a pessary also should really be on Vagifem as well, shouldn't they?
100% if they're
Yeah.
postmenopausal. Yeah. So
Yeah.
anyone who I put a pessary into, if there's no contraindication, I'll prescribe Vagifem as well. It makes it more comfortable, and they're less likely then to have so if a pessary is kind of rubbing against the skin of the vagina, it can cause a break in the skin called an erosion, which is a lot less likely if you're using Vagifem.
Yes. Yeah. And if you put a pessary in, don't forget about it, because there are cases of forgotten pessaries as well, aren't there?
Unfortunately, yeah.
And then what about laser? I see some just information sometimes online about laser, or on webinars, or even I saw recently this chair device that you sit into with, like it was being managed by a gynecologist, and then kind of laser therapy for prolapsing and incontinence. Do you do or see much of that, Breffni?
So laser, I would equate to Bulkamid. So very good for the patients that it will work for. As in, if you have mild stress incontinence, you don't leak very often, laser will usually be successful. So if you leak a small amount and infrequently, it will usually work quite well. But if you have more severe incontinence, it's a lot less likely to work. So usually what they it's literally a probe that's put into the vagina. You usually do three sessions of it over the space. It's usually every 4 to 6 weeks, or every kind of 2 to 6 weeks, depending on the clinician who's doing it. And usually then it needs to be topped up once a year.
Okay.
So it stimulates collagen in the vagina, and it increases the tensile strength of the vagina. It can also be used for mild prolapse, particularly in someone, say, who's postnatal or has very mild prolapse. It will improve those symptoms as well. But again, in more moderate to severe cases, it's less likely to work, and it's not inexpensive. I think it's 2 or 3 thousand for a session of three, and then I'm not sure
Oh,
how much the top-ups are,
okay.
and I don't know if it's covered by insurance. I don't think it is.
It might be, yeah, difficult to get it covered by insurance. Yeah, so important to just run that by your insurer before going ahead and knowing the cost of it. Is there anything we've missed, Breffni, you think is important to talk about in terms of incontinence and prolapse?
So I think the main thing with surgery versus pessaries versus conservative management with physio is, and a lot of people will come in, they're like, look, I'm really trying really hard with physio, it's just not getting anywhere. So I'm not getting anywhere and my symptoms are still there. Like the woman will know themselves what's working best for them. And if they have a pessary in and it's uncomfortable and they don't like it, then surgery is an option. But equally, like if they're very happy with their pessary, then they continue with their pessary. And some people will come in and they'll be in their late 30s or 40s and they're like, I'm not really young to be using this pessary. And it's like, well, you need something. And if you're happy taking it in and out yourself and it's working, then, and particularly a lot of women, like in that scenario, you would usually take it out for intercourse and they just feel a bit embarrassed by it, but it's more common than you think. So if they're happy to keep using their pessary, then I would usually say, look, let's just keep going with the pessary. And most people, the problem with surgery for prolapse is that the recurrence rate is about 30%. So if I do a hysterectomy and a repair of the front and back wall for your prolapse, 30% of women will need another surgery in the future. And that may be the top of the vagina is coming down or the bladder is coming down again. So it's not foolproof, because you're using your own tissues to do the repair in the first place. So when I'm counseling women, I usually will try a pessary first, But if they don't like it, then we'll look at surgery. But you very much have to go in with as much information as you can and make decisions based on that. So the International Urogynae Association has great patient information leaflets that I, most people that leave my clinic have about 10 pieces of paper leaving. Because you have to, like, doctors don't make decisions anymore. You give the pros, the cons, the complications, the success and the failure rates and what can go wrong. And it's very much, and people often say to me, well, what would you do if it was your mum? And I'm like, well, it depends. Like, my mum may not, like, maybe she likes to come in and get her pessary changed and have a chat every 6 months.
Yeah.
Maybe she doesn't want to do that because she lives too far away. Maybe she just wants to be done with it and have her surgery. It's very much empowering in a way. It's the woman who makes the decision. And we are just there to help them to do that. But yeah, prolapse and incontinence are unfortunately common, 10 to 15%, but treatable. So you shouldn't have to live with it.
Yeah, plenty of support and options available, you know. So in the first instance, you talk to your GP, and then speak with a gynecologist, you know, if a referral is needed, you know, check in your local area for pelvic floor physiotherapy as well. You know, they may be able to help you as well. And just look at those lifestyle things as well. They're really important. You know, the not drinking too much, because actually so much of the information online is, you know, drink water, drink water, drink water, you know, but there's, we actually, you know, maybe we need to limit it in some cases, you know, and, you know, managing constipation, not drinking too much tea, coffee, caffeinated drinks.
So some GPs actually do put in pessaries too. I've had a few GP pessaries, usually a ring pessary, and I've had physios as well. So that does exist. But usually it would be rare now for a GP to put in the likes of a Gellhorn or a shelf pessary.
No, I've done ring pessaries, but that's about it.
Yeah, and that's what you would expect. But like fitting a pessary is not, like, most of the time I'll get a first go because I do it all day long every day. But you may have some women you have to try 3 or 4 different sizes, and they'll walk out the door, you'll get them to walk around, go to the toilet, and it'll be comfortable, and then a week later it falls out. So it's not you, it's like finding, fitting the right shoe. It's, it takes a while sometimes.
Yeah, like getting the right pair of jeans. Yeah, one size does not fit all. Great, thank you so much, Refni. That was really interesting, and really hopefully that'll be helpful for anyone listening. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Take care. Bye-bye. Thank you so much for listening today. I really hope you enjoyed the episode. This episode was sponsored by Supplements Made Simple.